Let's turn our attention back to the book of beginnings, the book of Genesis. Chapter 5, verse 28 is our starting point today. This is the birth of Noah. And of course, he is the significant hero, key person in the story we're going to go over next, and that is the flood. This is what it says. When Lamech had lived 122 years, he fathered a son. Now, we've got some chronological information in here that I already talked about last time, but I want to just remind you, I am a person who prefers the numbers that are found in the Alexandrian Septuagint, because I believe they represent an older Hebrew Bible than the Masoretic text, which most of our English versions depend upon. So I think that chronology goes back farther into history than what most of our English Bibles represent. And so we're looking at the birth of Noah happening about 1,662 years into creation itself. And I put that in my chronology right around 3908 BC. If you're interested in my dealing with those issues, I recommend going to my Chronological Companion of the Bible. You can find this resource at intotheword2020.com. So here is Noah, born 1,600 plus years after creation has occurred. And he is given his name based on some sort of prophetic information that his father has. The word Noach in Hebrew has the idea of rest or comfort or calm. And this is what his dad says at his birth. Verse 29, he called his name Noah, saying, out of the ground that he who is has cursed. So that's a reference back to the first sin and the consequences of that sin that made the earth start falling into entropy, where it's starting to lose its organization and the ability to really get 100% out of what you put into it. So out of the ground that he who is has cursed, this one shall bring us relief from our work and from the painful toil of our hands. Now, it's possible that he simply had in mind, I've got another boy, and he's going to work the farm, and therefore, I won't have as much work to do myself. That's possible. But it's also possible that he has some sort of prophetic understanding that Noah has something big in his future, something that is going to be world-changing. And that most certainly is the case. And his genetic line, Noah's genetic line, is the only one that is going to go into the new world after the flood, and it will be from his line that Messiah comes, that the one who really brings true peace will ascend, and the only one that will reverse the curse. Because at the second coming, Jesus will make the new heaven and new earth where the curse has been done away with. So we keep that in our mind, and Lamech may have been aware on some level of that reality. Verse number 30. Lamech lived after he fathered Noah 595 years, had other sons and daughters, and thus all the days of Lamech were 777 years, and then he died. The Septuagint text has him living until he's 753. That's unusual because except for Enoch, who is taken away without dying, everybody else on this list has been living into their 900s. Why Lamech dies sooner, we don't know. We are not given that detail. But it is interesting that when we take Enoch and Lamech out of the equation, the average lifespan is up into the middle 900s. That will change radically after the flood occurs. And it's more than likely because of the change in the atmosphere, perhaps even the atmospheric pressure, the change in the nutritional nature of the topsoil and the plants that grow up out of it. Because once the flood occurs, you will see this huge drop in the average lifespan until it arrives right around where we're at today. Now, verse 32 starts getting into the story of the flood. It says, after Noah was 500 years old, Noah fathered Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And those are the three sons that will go onto the ark with Mr. and Mrs. Noah, their parents, and three women, unnamed, that are engaged to these three men. They're referred to as their wives, but these men seem to be still living at home. When we consider everything that we've looked at in the chronology yesterday, it would appear that the average age of the first child's birth in a family was in the 100s. So marriage was apparently delayed, childbearing was apparently delayed, which is not a problem if you're living up into the 900s. So these three sons are born in the 500s, the early 500s of Noah and Mrs. Noah. We actually can pin it down for Shem. He was born in the 502nd year of Noah's life. This seems to indicate to me that Mr. and Mrs. Noah must have had other children born previous to these that were out of the household, and that these other children, grown adults, were part of the destroyed and condemned flood generation. And that's a hard thing to think about, isn't it? All of us that are parents, it is our worst nightmare to imagine that after raising our children to believe in God and to be moral persons, would go out into the world and embrace the ungodly lifestyle and come under the judgment of God. And yet, I suggest to you that may have been the case for Mr. and Mrs. Noah's other kids. Chapter number 6, before we get into the flood story, we have to talk about how messed up the world was. And it starts with something that confuses a lot of people, and it's not helpful that some Bible teachers of the past have put out information that I think is erroneous. So let's look at Genesis chapter 6, starting at verse 1. When man, and what we've got in mind here is mankind, began to multiply on the face of the land, and daughters were born to them. Now, the gender is very specific here. We're talking about females. Now, what's important about females? They are the life givers. They are the child bearers. Men cannot do that on their own. They provide genetic input there, but it is the women who carry the child inside of them for 9 months and then give birth and become their very first teachers and nurturers. So if you want to fiddle around with the genetic code of humanity, if you want to mess around with the offspring of humanity, you target the young women. So here we have the daughters that were born into humanity, and verse 2 introduces another group of entities. The sons of God saw that these daughters of men were attractive. The word says literally good, and I'll come back to that in a moment. And they took them as their wives, any they chose. And the word wives, I think, is more specific than what is needed in the Hebrew context here. The sons of God in Hebrew is Ha Bene Elohim, the sons of the mighty ones. And this, in other places of Scripture, particularly in the book of Job, very clearly, is a reference to angelic beings. It is a reference to, in particular in this context, the fallen angelic beings that have gotten it into their heads they need to screw things up on planet Earth. It has become popular to try to take the story of the angels out of this discussion by metaphorically saying that these sons of God is a reference to the men in the Seth line, the righteous Seth line that is going to proceed into and through the flood, mixing with the non-Seth line, that would be all the other sons and daughters of Adam and Eve that were not righteous in their descendants, and that basically the males within the Seth line started marrying the females from these secondary unrighteous lines, and that's what got everything screwed up. Now, I can tell you exactly where this was first suggested as a theory, and it is well after the New Testament period. Julius Africanus, who was writing around AD 220, made the suggestion that these are not angels, as was commonly taught in the Jewish and Christian circles, but rather human beings of the Seth line. Let me give you the exact quote. "When men multiplied on the earth, the angels of heaven came together with the daughters of men. In some copies, I found, quote, the sons of God, end quote. What is meant by the Spirit, in my opinion, is that the descendants of Seth are called the sons of God on account of the righteous men and patriarchs who have sprung from him, even down to the Savior himself, but that the descendants of Cain are named the seed of men, as having nothing divine in them on account of the wickedness of their race and the inequality of their nature, being a mixed people and having stirred the..." "Having stirred the indignation of God. But if it is thought that these refer to angels, we must take them to be those who deal with magic and jugglery, who taught the women the motions of the stars and knowledge of things celestial, by whose power they conceived the giants as their children, by whom the wickedness came to its height on the earth, until God decreed that the whole race of the living should perish in their impiety by the deluge." End quote. So that's the very first time that the Seth being the sons of God and the Sethites being the sons of God and the daughters of men being all the women of alternate lines was first suggested. It was not the common universal teaching. And I think it's wrong. And I teach such. I believe any commentary that tries to promote this as the biblical understanding is way off base and needs to be rejected. And I have a good biblical reason for doing that. Because the book of Jude, and before him, the book of 2 Peter, uphold the idea that these sons of God were rebel angels, sinful angels causing trouble, and they ended up being judged. Let's go to 2 Peter chapter 2. We're going to start in verse 4 for the specific information we need, but the larger context is this. Peter is aware that there's false teachers coming into the church of the first century. He's not happy about it. And he points out that God always judges those that try to screw up his plans. That God always judges those who misappropriate things given by God. And this is what he writes specifically about angels. For if God did not spare angels when they sinned, but cast them into hell. I'm going to correct the word. It's actually Tartarus, which is distinct from everlasting judgment hell. Tartarus was a place of temporary confinement in the spirit world. And I'll get into that in a moment. So, but cast them into Tartarus and committed them to chains of gloomy darkness to be kept until the judgment. Now, that should be like a dot, dot, dot after that. He goes on and gives some other examples before he gets back to his point. And that is, if rebels of the past didn't get away with God judging them, why would these false teachers in the church think that they're going to get away with it? God will judge them. The only possible place that Peter could be referencing is Genesis chapter 6. These fallen angels were punished by God with being pulled out of our world and put into a temporary holding place, sometimes also known as the abyss. That's going to come up in the book of Revelation later. And they will remain there until God is ready to deal with them. Now, we have a little bit more information on what Peter's talking about when Jude later uses Peter's remarks as a framework for his own letter. He's fighting with the same stuff, false teachers in the church, and he feels he has to deal with them strongly and talk about how God is not going to put up with such things happening in the church without eventually coming down hard on it. And he uses the exact same illustrations that Peter did. And so Book of Jude, there's only one chapter there, and we're going to go down to verse number 6, where he starts talking about these fallen angels. And the angels who did not stay within their own position of authority. Now, the New American Standard uses the term proper abode, which is closer to the original language. The word that is used by Paul here, by Jude here, is also used by the Apostle Paul over in 2 Corinthians 5, verse number 2, with a specific reference to the body, the physical body in which our spirit dwells. And so there is some indication here in Jude's writing that these angels didn't stay where they belonged. In fact, they apparently didn't even stay within their bodies where they belonged. Instead, they did this. Back to Jude 6. But left their proper dwelling, he has kept in eternal chains under gloomy darkness until the judgment of the great day. So these angels in Genesis chapter 6 didn't stay where they belonged, which was out of human affairs. Instead, they started monkeying with the genetic code, trying to corrupt the human line and corrupt human thinking. And all of the extra-biblical legends bear this out. Pretty much all the cultures of the world teach that at some point in the past, these divine beings, sometimes known as gods, but in our text we talk about them being angels, come to planet Earth and start monkeying around with the genetic code and also start giving humankind information that in the opinion of the more senior gods should not be given to them. And this causes great trouble, and eventually judgment falls, typically in the form of a worldwide flood that only a man and his family seemed to survive. So you can tell in all those legends, all the extra-biblical traditions, this is all related to the flood story. So with that sort of background, let me go back to the inspired text of Genesis chapter 6 and reread it and talk about it from that perspective. So Genesis chapter 6, verse 2, the sons of God, meaning fallen angels, saw that the daughters of mankind were good. It wasn't that they were looking at their beauty. There's a different Hebrew word for that. They are looking at their usefulness, their design, and they were designed to produce offspring. And so they took these women, any of them that they chose. That's the better rendering of the Hebrew text. It's not that they were marrying them. It's almost as if they were abducting them and using them to produce a hybrid race that maybe they would have better control of. Now, some of the legends do have marriage involved, but the marriage is always associated with the idea that these fallen angels were teaching these women all sorts of occult information, things that were beyond what they'd already learned, advanced information, and from moral perspectives, information that could get them engaged in sinful behavior. Julius Africanus actually referenced all of that in our quote a little while ago. If you will bear with me, I'm going to throw out something to you that it's going to make maybe a few of you uncomfortable, but for others of you, it's going to make a light bulb go off. Some of you have already heard me talk about this, so you already are either on board with me on this, or you're like still fighting me on it. We have a strange phenomena in the modern world where people claim that they have been abducted by alien beings, that these alien beings that they have contact with usually try to present themselves as the saviors of mankind. In fact, they sometimes present themselves as the original designers of mankind, and that they are here trying to help, but they need genetic material. And so they take sperm and they take ovum. Some of these abduction stories even have the women being shown their hybrid offspring later, being told, this is what we've done with all the material that we got from you. Now, this, in my opinion, sounds an awful lot like what I think Genesis 6:2 is representing. And so I wonder whether or not the fallen angels are up to it again. I think they did it before the flood, and the flood took out their offspring. I think they might have done it again around the area of Sodom and Gomorrah, because there are giants, which we're about to come to in our consideration here, not maybe today, but later. There are giants in the stories related to Sodom and Gomorrah. And then now I think they're at it again in this time period that I believe is leading up to the second coming of Jesus Christ. So I wouldn't poo-poo very quickly a lot of the abduction stories that you hear. I think they might be a recurrence of fallen angel activities. So Genesis chapter 6, verse 2 is followed by verse 3. Then, so apparently in the context of this hybridization issue, he who is said, my spirit will not abide in man forever, for he is flesh. His days shall be 120 years. Now, a lot of Bible commentaries take this as the indication that the time period that Noah was building the ark was 120 years long. However, the ancient opinion was that this was God saying, I am not going to put up with these long-lived humans fighting my spirit forever. They all die after several hundred years, but I am going to now do something that will drop that age period even lower to 120. And we know that after the flood, the average age rapidly dropped until right around the time of Moses and others, the upper threshold seems to have landed right around 120 years. That's actually where we're at today. When you hear about the oldest people in the world, they're usually about 122, 123, but they can't last any longer than that. I find it interesting that in some scientific writings a few years back, people that were not Christians were saying, for some reason in our research, the human cell can't get beyond roughly 120 years. And so I believe all of this is related in what we're about to study next, the flood which changed the world.